police report. He's not crying, but that's what I feel like doing.
Your grandpa and grandma. What a pair of characters they were, Billy. I wish you could have known them.
Me too.
It comes out as a dry squeak. I feel like a monster for bringing up such a painful subject. Dad reaches over and pats my arm.
It's all right, son. I think about them every day. I need to. You understand?
A nod is all I've got left. What saves me from turning into a total bawling mess is the sight of a jet black Range Rover screeching into the parking lot of the Lonesome Rooster. Trailing close behind is the gray kennel truck. My father straightens in his seat and flicks on the windshield wipers again. A bent-nosed man who can only be Lincoln Chumley Baxter IV steps out of the Range Rover wearing full storm weather camo gear and mouthing a fat brown cigar. Axel Burnside emerges from the kennel truck shielding his cowboy hat with a folded newspaper. In the beating rainstorm, the dog trainer and the poacher stand toe-to-toe. The conversation doesn't look warm and friendly. My father has a trace of a smile as he studies the unhappy pair. Summer sits forward to watch.
What do you think they're arguing about? I ask Dad.
I've got no idea, he says, but it's a glorious way to get this party started.
13. Nobody knows the exact number of panthers that are left in Florida, but biologists say it's less than 300. The surviving cats are skittish and solitary animals that try to stay away from humans, which isn't easy in a state where more than 1,000 new humans arrive every single day. A few years ago, scientists imported some Texas cougars to mate with the remaining panthers in the hope their kittens would grow up stronger and tougher. The problem is, they've basically run out of territory to roam. Most of the old scrub woods and prairies are now concrete, subdivisions and strip malls, while the last of the wide open spaces are cross-hatched by highways. Lots of young panthers get killed by cars. Yet, despite the constant crush of civilization, the animals are rarely seen. They travel after dark across farms and cattle ranches to hunt wild hogs, deer, or, occasionally, calves. While some landowners don't mind the big cats hanging around, others feel just the opposite. Dad suspects an unsympathetic rancher complained to somebody about a visiting panther. That person then tipped off Lincoln Chumley Baxter IV, who reached out to Axel Burnside and his legendary barkless hounds. The argument between the poacher and the dog man outside the Lonesome Rooster had ended with each man stomping through the puddles to a different room. I bet they were fighting about money, Summer said as she climbed into bed. Dad was doubtful.
Baxter's so rich he can afford to double or triple whatever Burnside charges for a hunt.
Then what else could it be? I ask.
Let's get some rest.
He turned off the lights and tugged the blanket up to his chin. By midnight, he and Summer were snoring like walruses. I was still awake on the floor, trading texts with my mother, who wanted to know why we were camping at a roadside motel. I told her it was too rainy to pitch a tent. She said Belinda might split up with Dawson, not exactly heartbreaking news. It would save me the trouble of telling my sister that the blockhead she was dating tried to take out the neighbor's cat with a slingshot. Mom said another boy from school had asked Belinda for a date, and she was deciding whether or not to like him. He was an AP student, heading for Yale. I said anybody with an IQ higher than a doorknob's would be an improvement over Dawson. Afterward, I dimmed the phone, tucked it under my pillow, and closed my eyes. At 3 in the morning, Dad's alarm chimed, rousing me from an awful dream. I was trapped inside a car that was sinking in a lake. Turtles with glowing yellow eyes were swimming all around, peering through the windshield. Now I'm fumbling around, trying to roll up my sleeping bag. I can't seem to line up the corners.
"We'll stop for coffee," my father says. Summer looks as groggy as I am, but Dad's totally wired and ready to go. He says we need to be hiding on location before Baxter and Burnside arrive with the hounds. Last night at dinner, he'd ordered 3 medium-rare hamburgers to go. His plan is to use the drone to airdrop the meat patties, distracting the dogs from the panther's scent. The odds of this plan succeeding are about 1 in a trillion, based on what I've read about walker hounds. Once they catch an animal scent, nothing short of an earthquake can break their concentration. Dad insists it's worth a try. The bag of burgers goes in the red pickup with the rest of our gear, including the quadcopter, which I still don't know how to fly. Because of all the rain, I never got my pilot lesson. The damp streets are empty, and the traffic signals are blinking yellow. We're the only customers at the 7-Eleven. Dad and Summer beeline for the coffee machine while I grab a bottle of tea. It's so cold inside the store that the front window is fogged. The clerk is actually wearing a ski sweater. "How far is the place we're going?" I ask my father.
9.4 miles. When we get there, we might have a gate issue.
"I can pick a lock," Summer volunteers. When I give her a look, she says, "What, you don't believe me?" Dad buys a box of cinnamon rolls, and we all agree not to peek at the expiration date. That's how hungry we are. The door of the 7-Eleven opens with an electronic cheep, and in walks Axel Burnside. He doesn't seem to recognize me, probably because today I'm wearing a hoodie. Standing at the register, he asks the clerk for a carton of cigarettes. Dad, Summer, and I slip outside to the parking lot, where we can hear the dogs scrabbling inside the vented aluminum kennels on Burnside's truck.
"Let's get out of here," Dad says, and we scramble into his pickup.
Summer buckles up quickly. Not me. Sometimes an idea pops into my head, the opposite of common sense, but I just can't let it be. The moment my father turns the ignition key, I hear myself blurting, "Hold on, I forgot something."
"No, Billy, don't go back in there."
Too late. I'm fairly sure Dad won't follow me because he can't afford to let Burnside see his face. He needs to stay undercover. Inside the 7-Eleven, the dog man taps a scarred, deformed finger on the counter while the store clerk reloads the coffee machine. I pull down my hoodie and say, "Hey, remember me? How's Candy, Andy, and Mandy?" His response is a granite stare, although he looked meaner yesterday behind those mirrored sunglasses. His eyes are light green and not particularly badass.
"Why aren't you home in bed at this hour, boy?"
he asks. "I'm here to do you a favor." He laughs gruffly, showing a top row of stained teeth.
"You gonna do me a favor? Such as what?"
"Such as keeping your butt out of jail," I say. The clerk glances up from the coffee machine. Burnside grabs my arm and steers me to the rear of the store, the aisle with all the chips and dips. "Take it easy," I say. "They've got security cameras everywhere." He releases my arm.
"Talk, boy."
My hands are a little shaky, so I shove them in my pockets. "I know who you are and why you're here," I tell him. "This isn't Texas, okay? And you're not hunting regular mountain lions. Did you even bother to look up the law on endangered species? 'Cause if you get caught with a dead Florida panther, they'll put you in handcuffs and confiscate those expensive hounds for evidence." I'm not certain if that last part is true, but I'm definitely making Axel Burnside uncomfortable, which is the whole point.
"Just who are you, boy?"
"I'm nobody." The clerk calls out,
"Dude, your coffee's getting cold.
Let's you and me go out front,
says the dog man. They got cameras there, too.
I'm aware of that.
I go outside to wait while Axel Burnside pays for his coffee. My father looks like he's ready to vault out of the pickup and charge across the parking lot, but I give him a low wave that says, relax, I got this. He and Summer slide low in their seats so they won't be seen. The first thing Burnside does when he leaves the store is fire up a cigarette. He blows the smoke over one shoulder, props an elbow on the kennel truck, and orders the excited dogs inside to settle down. Personally, I don't see much sport in what you do, I say, but you've got a reputation in the big game world as a straight operator.
And you know that how?
I hold up my cell phone. By reading everything I could find about you, blogs, newspaper stories, magazine articles. They say you're such a big deal, there's a waiting list of people who want to go hunting with you and those dogs. But, see, I wonder what would happen to your business if you went out and killed an animal on the endangered list. The dog man studies his coffee.
You mean, what would happen if word got out?
Oh, word would get out, I say. Count on that. His pale gaze narrows.
You got some guts, boy.
Mr. Burnside, I've never laid eyes on a wild Florida panther, but I would like to someday. So I've got a big problem with what you're doing. He sets the coffee cup on the fender of the truck, pulls a scuffed leather wallet out of his jacket, and hands it to me.
Count the cash in there. Go on.
But I don't want any money. That's not why I'm here.
Just count it up, boy.
3 20s, 2 10s, and a $1 bill. $81, I say, placing the bills back in the wallet and the wallet back in his hand.
Know how much I had on me yesterday? $20,081. Are you listening?
Burnside takes a sneering drag off the cigarette.
Rich fella from California, he calls up and says he and his college fraternity brothers are doing a big coon hunt. They're all making bets on first and biggest, and he wants me to be his personal guide. When I tell him my usual fee, which ain't cheap, he says, no problem, partner. So I drive my three walkers all the way from San Antonio, and when I get here, he drops this fat stack of cash on the table. I count it all out and say, mister, this is way too much. Nobody in their right mind would ever pay that kind of money to track a damn raccoon. And he says, that's not what we're gonna hunt. Then when he tells me what it is he really wants to shoot, well, I can't repeat the words that came out of my mouth. This was at a Cracker Barrel, too.
We saw you guys arguing outside the motel.
Yeah, that was shortly after,
Burnside says. After what?
After I threw the man's cash in his face.
He picks up his coffee and opens the truck door.
I got a long drive home,
he says. I'm sorry, Mr. Burnside. I didn't know.
Whatever you might think of me, boy, I don't break the law.
I ask about the scar on his twisted finger.
Snake bite. It was either me or Andy, so I took the hit. He's dumber than the other two dogs put together, comes to rattlers.
Diamondback?
A 6-footer thick as my arm. You know your snakes, huh?
Can I ask one more thing, Mr. Burnside?
Make it quick.
How do you train those hounds not to bark?
Trade secret,
he answers with a raspy chuckle.
Love, patience, and lots of bacon treats.
Sometimes you can be dead wrong about a person. Once the embarrassment of your mistake passes, it's actually a good feeling, being surprised in a positive way by human behavior. Not everyone lives by a code of honor, but the dog man does. He said no to a major pile of money. I wait until the kennel truck's taillights are out of sight before running to my father's pickup. When I tell Dad what Axel Burnside said, he gives a joyful whoop and says, "The hunt's off! Let's hit the road!" Summer starts rocking out, doing jazz hands in the back seat. I grab the dog bait hamburgers Dad bought last night, dash back into the 7-Eleven, and motor straight for the microwave. That's our breakfast, and those day-old burgers taste fantastic. The cinnamon buns we're saving for later. The town of Immokalee is in the rearview mirror when Dad's phone starts ringing. He presses the answer button and crows, "I've got some amazing news." Pause. "What? Say that again?" Another pause, heavier than the first. "Are you serious? But how?" Dad pulls his foot off the gas pedal. "Tell me where he is!" he shouts at the phone. Now he's turning the truck in a steep 180, tires yelping on the pavement. I spin around to look at Summer, who offers a bleak shake of her head. Dad tosses the phone in my lap and slams the heel of his fist against the dashboard. "Was that your informant?" Summer asks.
"Correct."
"So what's wrong, Dennis?"
"The panther hunt is still on. That's what's wrong."
His tone is oddly flat, showing no trace of the anger he must be feeling. It can't be easy facing the fact you've got a fool for a son. I tell him how sorry I am. "The dog man lied to me. He said he was driving straight back to Texas. He stood there lying to my face, and I believed every stupid word."
"Burnside wasn't lying. He's gone," Dad says, still with that dull metal voice. "Lincoln Baxter's doing the hunt all by himself. He's on his way to the ranch right now."
The speedometer says 66, which is 21 miles per hour over the speed limit. Getting stopped by police is the last thing we need, but there's not much I could say that would make my father slow down. Summer asks how Baxter can find a panther if he's not using the hunting dogs. Dad says,
"Same way he does it with grizzlies, I guess."
"Except big cats don't show themselves the way bears do."
"If they're hungry enough, they might."
Summer sniffs. "I predict he won't even get a shot."
"Can we take that chance?" "No."
My father ends the discussion by cranking up the radio. After a few miles, he relaxes his death grip on the steering wheel, and the speedometer needle begins to drop. When it hits 45, I turn down the music. Dad doesn't object. "Don't you think it's weird," I ask, "that your informant, whoever he is, would know exactly what the poacher's doing at 4 in the morning?
"I wouldn't say that's weird."
"Then he must be tailing him like we are."
"No, Billy, my informant is not sneaking around following Lincoln Baxter."
"Then how does he know so much?" Summer demands.
"Because my informant isn't a he," says Dad. "She's a she."
Now I get the picture. It's a love story gone wrong. 14. I've never had an official girlfriend. There were friends who happened to be girls, but we never got to relationship status. The one I liked most, I guess, was Anna Lee. This was when we lived in Key Largo. She was a star volleyball player, even though she stood barely 5 feet tall. I forget where we met or how the subject of unusual hobbies came up. But on the afternoons she didn't have volleyball practice, we'd ride our bikes up Country Road 905 to hunt for snakes. We were scouting old junk piles, which are major reptile magnets, because of all the mice and rats. Anna Lee had no fear. I'd flip over a board or a scrap of sheet metal, and she'd grab anything she saw, even black racers and coach whips, which bite like maniacs. I've never met any person with faster moves than Anna Lee. She wouldn't wear gloves either, even in the upland hammocks, where scorpions were an issue. poisonous centipedes, too. Anna Lee wasn't scared of anything. I wish I could remember her last name. Goldman? Goldstein? Goulding? I could probably find her somewhere online, but then what? Exactly. She's there, and I'm... wherever. Lincoln Chumley Baxter IV married a girlfriend of his named Daisy Marlowe. The ceremony took place at one of the many Baxter family estates. Daisy loved the outdoors, though not for the same reasons as Lincoln. He bought her a fancy Italian shotgun, and she got pretty good at blasting clay pigeons out of the air, but she had no desire to shoot real birds or anything else that was alive. Daisy Marlowe Baxter wasn't aware her husband was a big game poacher until my father told her. Then she became his secret informant. According to Dad, their one and only meeting took place after he followed her to a fancy spa and wellness resort in a place called Monterey. Daisy Baxter was lying on a massage table under a tall white tent overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Her face, arms, and legs were plastered with green healing clay that smelled suspiciously like Play-Doh, and her eyes were covered with slices of cucumber. That's the reason she didn't see my father scaling the wall of the resort. She was startled to hear a strange voice saying, "Mrs. Baxter, there's something you ought to know about Lincoln. Something that might test your affections." A security guard tried to hustle Dad off the property, but Daisy Baxter sat up, flicked the cucumbers off her eyelids, and said she wanted to hear what this odd, soft-spoken trespasser had to say. Dad recalled being uneasy because Mrs. Baxter wore only a towel. He politely aimed his gaze elsewhere while he explained that a hunter friend of his had been approached by Lincoln Baxter about guiding him to a Yellowstone grizzly bear. Daisy Baxter became very upset. "I suspected Link was up to something shady, but I had no idea it was this bad. How can I help?"
"Convince him to stop. Tell him how wrong it is, and not just because it's illegal. He'll listen to you."
"Are you kidding?" Mrs. Baxter replied. "He'll look me dead in the eye and claim he doesn't know what I'm talking about. I've questioned him before about these special hunts, and he swears they're legit, except he never posts any pictures, which is strange."
That's my father's memory of the first conversation with his informant. It might not be word for word, but it's probably pretty close. The bottom line is that Daisy Baxter agreed to contact Dad whenever Lincoln went on one of his suspicious trips. She checks in often with her husband, like she did a few minutes ago, and the next call she makes is to my father. She even bought an app called Spouse Finder, which can locate Baxter within a radius of 200 yards, using the GPS signal in his phone. In exchange for her supplying all that key information, Dad made one promise to Daisy. He would never personally do anything to harm her husband.
"Does that include getting him tossed in jail?" Summer asks.
"Oh, Mrs. Baxter's got no problem with that," Dad says. "She thinks the experience might straighten him out, though I doubt it. He's got plenty of money for bail and slick lawyers." We're approaching the ranch on a long, unpaved road. Dad's no longer in touch with Mrs. Baxter because the cell service quit, but a fresh set of tire tracks is visible on the packed gravel ahead. Dad switches off the headlights so nobody will see us coming. He drives extra slowly, watching for stray cattle and a black Range Rover. A bank of wispy fog makes it feel like we're bouncing through the clouds. Summer and I are wide awake now. "What would happen," I ask my father, "if Baxter found out his wife was secretly helping you monkey wrench these hunts? Would he hurt her?"
"She's got a black belt, Billy. We're talking Taekwondo. Daisy Baxter's not afraid of Lincoln."
"Would he leave her if he knew the truth?"
A better question, Summer pipes from the back seat, is why she doesn't leave him. Dad says he's obviously no expert on marriage.
Some are more complicated than others. That's one of the few things I know for sure.
The gate to the ranch property is made of wire fencing and aluminum crossbars. A no trespassing sign is screwed to one of the wood posts, and a no hunting sign is nailed to the other. We could easily climb over, but Dad doesn't want to leave his truck parked on the dirt road where ranch workers would notice it. They'd call a towing company and then come looking for us. Hanging from the gate latch is a heavy-duty brass padlock. Summer tries to pick it open with a bent paperclip. The lock won't surrender, and I can hear her cussing under her breath.
My turn, Dad says impatiently, pulling out a pair of bolt cutters.
After he steers the truck through the entrance, I shut the gate behind us and hang the broken lock back on the latch. A few miles down the ranch road, we finally nose out of the fog. Dad coaxes the pickup into a thick stand of palmettos, the fronds squeaking against the paint. He turns off the engine, and we sit to listen. The mockingbirds are waking, and cows bray in the distance. A soft violet glow in the sky means the sun will be rising soon. Hungry mosquitoes pour into the cab of the truck.
Vicious little vampires,
my father growls. We jump out and spray each other's clothes with bug juice. Summer and I sort the hiking gear while Dad prepares the spy quadcopter. He wants it airborne at daybreak. Lincoln Chumley Baxter IV is nearby, stalking a panther. I wonder where, Summer says. The answer comes with the crack of a gunshot echoing across the misty scrub. My father looks up from the drone and says,
"Oh no."
One time, before Belinda or I was born, Dad surprised Mom with a trip to see wild flamingos, her second favorite bird on the planet. They drove through Everglades National Park to a place actually called Flamingo on the shore of Florida Bay. In a rented boat, they went searching for a famous flock that lived near the tidal flats, not far from the ranger station. But that day, the flamingos weren't there, not even one. My mother took lots of cool pictures of blue herons, white pelicans, cormorants, and even a pair of roseate spoonbills. She had a fantastic trip, but Dad was bummed because he couldn't find the only birds he'd promised to show her. A few years later, waiting at a dentist's office, he saw a magazine article about a place in the Bahamas where flamingos can be found any time of the year, guaranteed. Right away, he started planning another expedition. Mom pointed out that they now had two small children and that an island vacation wasn't cheap. Dad said no problem and charged the plane tickets to their credit card. Then he took Belinda and me to the courthouse to get U.S. passports, which we used exactly once for that Bahamas trip. I'd like to say I remember it, but maybe looking through Mom's photo album makes me think I remember. After all, I was only 2½. Even so, I carry in my mind a crystal vision of those flamingos, rows and rows of them wading with slow jointed strides across the shallows. With bowed heads, they stir their down-curved bills through the clear water, sifting for tiny brine shrimp and baby crabs. As our motorboat approaches, the birds all stop feeding and turn toward the sound of the engine. One starts to flap away and more follow, rising in soft puffs of color. Some have blood orange feathers, some are hot pink, and the younger ones look pale, almost milky. The front edges of their wings are as black as asphalt, matching the tips of their bills. The flamingos rise in clusters before melting together into a single V-shaped squadron. They aren't exactly sleek. Their heads seem too heavy for those long, thin necks, and their legs dangle behind them like loose ropes. Yet flying as a single wave, they make an unforgettable sight, a swipe of creamy rose paint on a bright blue canvas. I see my mother in the bow of the boat, aiming her camera at the soaring birds. My father sits beside her, his hands steadying her shoulders. There's no picture in Mom's photo album of the two of them like that, but I swear I remember the moment. Belinda won't admit she remembers, too. She'll say only that after Dad set me on her lap, I kept waving and waving at the flamingos until they disappeared beyond the mangroves. Sometimes, when the memory of that morning gets hazy, I take out my passport just to look at the ink stamp that says Bahamas Immigration. The passport is expired now, but I'll probably hang on to it. Belinda says that island trip was the last real family thing we did together. Mom never figured out how my father paid off the credit card bill, but my guess is Aunt Sophie helped. What made me think about the wild flamingos is the red-topped sandhill crane that's studying us now as we creep through the Everglades scrub. Sandhills are my mother's third favorite bird. Like bald eagles and flamingos, they usually choose a mate for life. This one is out walking all by itself. Summer whispers, "We've got sandhills in Montana, too." It's weird to see a girl carrying a shotgun, but then again, I've never seen anybody carrying a shotgun. Dad assures me that Summer knows how to shoot. "And it's got nothing to do with being a crow," she adds, throwing me a sharp look. "The key is good eyes and steady hands." "I'll take your word for it," I say. Guns make me nervous. So do gunshots. When most people hear one, the natural impulse is to go the other way. We're doing just the opposite, sneaking toward the shooter as quickly as we can. The unspoken fear is that we're too late, that the shot we heard was Lincoln Chumley Baxter IV killing one of the last panthers in Florida. My father is carrying the quadcopter. I've got the hatchet, bug spray, binoculars, water bottles, and a few protein bars that we dug out of the console in the truck. The lonesome sandhill crane croaks loudly as we trudge past. Normally, I'd stop and text a photo to Mom, but we're in a major hurry. Summer and I are still eagerly waiting to hear Dad's master plan. "It's flexible," he tells us. "So it's not really a plan," I say. "It's more of a floating concept." "Keep your voice down, Billy." We're following a game trail so narrow that we're forced to move single file. Summer goes first because she's the one with the gun. When Dad asks her if the safety switch is on, she sighs, "Of course, duh." We're all jittery, breathing fast. When a spooked rabbit darts between Dad and me, I jump like 2 feet in the air. Finally, we enter a small clearing, and Dad motions for me to pass him the binoculars. "You see something?"
"Stay low, please. Both of you."
Summer and I drop to the ground. My father raises the binoculars and clearly dials in on something.
"What is it?"
Summer asks.
"Baxter's Range Rover. He tried to cover it with palmetto branches, but I see the sun glinting off the chrome grill."
"But do you see him?"
I ask.
"Not yet."
"So it's drone time."
"Correct."
Dad hands me the binoculars.
"You're kneeling in an ant pile, son."
There's nothing like firebolts of pain to take a person's mind off a sketchy situation. These particular ants, the nasty red variety, have scaled my hiking shoes and sneaked under the cuffs of the pants I foolishly thought would protect me. Now the little ghouls are biting my legs. I roll on the ground, kicking and clawing at myself, trying not to yell. Summer has intelligently scooted out of the way. By the time I finish neutralizing the nibbling insects, the quadcopter is in the air. You're probably thinking, what kind of father would take 2 kids into a wilderness to chase down a heavily armed poacher? Don't forget, this wasn't Dad's idea. Summer and I each ask to go with him, and we made it difficult for him to say no. We've both got a secret he wants us to keep. The drone is circling high above the Range Rover. We see what the aircraft's camera sees. The live image is displayed on Dad's smartphone, clipped to the remote control box. When the poacher eventually comes into view, he's a speck in the swamp. Dad lowers the quadcopter for a closer view. Lincoln Chumley Baxter IV is garbed all in camo, no surprise. He moves through the glades like someone who's not supposed to be there, carrying a long black object that can only be a rifle. A large, limp animal is slung around his neck. The animal's fur is tan. My stomach twists into a hot knot as I think about the gunshot we heard.
"He did it!" I blurt angrily. "We're too late, Dad!"
"No, son, we're not."
"What are you talking about? Just look!"
"That's not a panther he killed," says Summer. "It's a deer." Suddenly, the poacher crouches and looks upward, as if he hears something. Dad toggles the quadcopter's controls, sending it higher and eastward, where it can't be seen by a person squinting into the glare of a rising sun. Once again, Baxter appears bug-sized on the video. However, he has resumed moving, apparently satisfied that he's alone on the hunt. "So he shot the deer for bait," I say to Dad. "Without Burnside's dogs, that's all he can do."
"How do we stop him?" Summer asks. "It's time to make, like, a real plan."
"If the panther shows up, we buzz him with the drone and spook him off before Baxter can take a shot," Dad says. "Just like I did with the grizzly at Tom Minor."
Summer is skeptical. "But we could be waiting on that cat for hours. What happens when the drone's batteries run out?"
I thought of the same thing, but my father reacts like it's a silly question. "Ever heard of a power pack? I brought 4 of them. No, 5.
"Hey, Dad," I say.
"What?"
"Where's the bad guy?"
Uh-oh. The three of us are hunched shoulder to shoulder over the remote control unit. Lincoln Baxter is no longer visible on the quadcopter's camera feed.
"Where'd he go? What happened?"
Summer says with a groan. Dad looks slightly sick to his stomach. "He didn't go anywhere. It's the drone that's moving away."
"All by itself?"
"They do this sometimes," he mumbles, frantically working the joysticks.
"Do what sometimes?" I ask.
"It's called a flyaway. They just, you know, fly away." Summer and I glance at each other, wondering the same thing. How far away is away? The remote begins beeping rapidly, probably not a good sign. Summer asks Dad if the drone will return on its own. "It's not a dog," he says.
"So how are we going to find it?"
"Don't worry, there's a built-in GPS tracker." "I hope it works underwater," I say. The quadcopter is plummeting toward what is obviously a pond. The brown and black objects we see dotting the shoreline are thirsty cows. Desperately, my father claws at the control levers, which has no effect. Summer and I watch helplessly as the aircraft's video shows the shimmering body of water looming larger by the second. The queasy descent ends with a splash. Then Dad's phone beeps faintly and goes black. He sets down the remote. The flight is over.
"If a drone hits the water," he explains gloomily, "it's dead as a doornail. The electronics drown instantly."
Summer lowers her head.
"So we're done? Just like that?"
Having lost our eye in the sky, it will be almost impossible to spy on the poacher without drawing his attention and possibly a warning shot.
"We should probably get out of here," I tell Dad.
"Hold on, Billy. I've got a plan B."
"It can't be great," Summer grumbles.
And it's not great. In fact, it's more like a plan B minus. But we take a vote. None of us is ready to give up the mission. 15. I don't know who called the sheriff. Maybe nobody did. Maybe the deputy was being truthful when he told us he was on routine patrol and heard all the racket. Like I said, it wasn't a great plan to begin with. Make lots of noise, basically, enough to scare the panther. The cats are frightened of people, and they'll bolt from any sign of human activity, and we all wanted that one to run away. It was a big, tawny male. Summer was the first to notice the tracks, but I was the one who spotted the animal moving in the direction of the poacher. Who, Dad whispered, was likely perched in a tree overlooking the carcass of the deer he'd shot earlier. Laying eyes on the panther was lucky, unexpected, and unreal. At first I thought that it must be a mirage, that subconsciously I'd made myself imagine it. It was the same feeling I got after seeing the grizzly in Montana. But just like the bear, the panther was no illusion. Dad and Summer caught a glimpse too. With swift, taut strides, it crossed a clearing, its ropey black-tipped tail seeming longer than the cat itself. That would have been an ideal time to launch the drone, except the drone was at the bottom of a cattle pond. That's why we needed another way to scare the panther, meaning Plan B minus. Dad was firing his gun into the air, Summer was beating a heavy stick on the trunk of a dead pine, and I was honking the horn of the Range Rover that Lincoln Chumley Baxter IV had neglected to lock. The keys were in the ignition, and a smelly half-smoked cigar sat in the cup holder. On the passenger seat was a yellow scrap of paper. A name and phone number had been written on it. The instant Dad started shooting, I mashed both hands on the horn and held it down. It was loud. So was the gun. So was Summer's tree whacking. The woods got very noisy, very fast. Every living creature within a mile probably heard the ruckus. The panther, which was much closer than a mile, undoubtedly ran away. Fear will cause even the hungriest wild animal to lose its appetite. My father had brought a dozen shotgun shells. They didn't last long. As soon as he finished firing, we sprinted to his truck and made a teeth-rattling race for the ranch gate, which was blocked by a police car. The sheriff's deputy stood there twirling the broken padlock on his finger.
"You're trespassing," he said, "with a firearm."
My father told him about the poacher who was stalking a panther.
"He killed a deer, too, and they're out of season. The man's name is Lincoln Baxter, and he drives a black Range Rover. I can show you where he is."
The deputy said, "Deer hunters use rifles. What I heard was a shotgun." My father pointed to his in the bed of the truck.
"It's right there, officer."
"Sir, what were you shooting at?"
"Nothing," I interrupted. "He was firing in the air." "To spook the cat," Summer added. The deputy checked Dad's gun to make sure it was empty. After writing down our names and dates of birth, he told us to get back in the pickup. An hour later, we're still here. The deputy took my father's keys to prevent him from driving off, which I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have done. But with no car keys, we can't turn on the engine, which means no air conditioning. It's too hot outside to roll up the windows, so the mosquitoes are enjoying a hearty breakfast of human blood. Ours.
"Sorry, guys," Dad says.
Summer asks if we're going to jail.
"Not you two," he replies.
"Me? Possibly."
The deputy is on his phone. Soon a jacked-up swamp truck with humongous mud tires appears. The driver is a chunky young man with red hair and a red mustache. He wears a trucker cap, worn jeans, and dirty boots. The deputy brings him over to have a look at us.
"This fellow works on the ranch," the deputy says to Dad. "Tell him what you told me."
My father repeats the account of the poacher and the panther. The ranch hand responds with a blank expression.
I just come from down that way and didn't see nobody. No non-authorized vehicles neither.
I know exactly where the hunter is. I can take you, Dad insists.
Ain't nobody else out there,
the ranch hand says flatly. He turns to the deputy.
The boss man wants these jokers off the property.
Does he intend to press charges?
Not unless they went and killed something.
Well, they killed his padlock.
The deputy shows the battered remains to the ranch hand. My father flips open his wallet.
Will $50 take care of that?
Make it $100, says the ranch hand, to cover my time and inconvenience.
Not actually a real word. I keep my mouth shut as Dad gives the man two $50 bills. Summer is boiling.
Rip off!
She fake coughs under her breath. I lean out the truck window and say, Hey, are you Rusty? The ranch hand whirls in surprise.
Who told you that, kid?
I got your name from the same man you say isn't out here hunting panthers. Rusty's cheeks turn almost as red as his hair. He stomps back to his four-wheeler and roars away.
I'm not sure what's going on, the deputy says to us, but the smartest thing you folks can do is follow me out of here.
Dad says,
Ready when you are, officer.
The cinnamon buns were stale and gummy. We were too hungry to care.
How'd you know that man's name? My father asks.
It was on a piece of paper in Baxter's SUV.
Soon as the guy rolled up, I figured it had to be him. With that hair, right?
Summer says, So, rude Mr. Ranch Hand was in on the whole thing. My father is sure that was Baxter's inside connection.
The ranch owner probably doesn't know anything about this. That's why Rusty didn't want the deputy to press charges. He couldn't risk us telling a judge what we saw. If it got out that he was in business with a poacher, he'd get fired in 2 seconds.
Dad says there's a web network of outlaw hunters who travel the world stalking rare and endangered species. They put out the word that they're willing to pay $50 to shoot certain animals, a grizzly in Montana, for example, or a black rhinoceros in South Africa, and usually somebody's greedy enough to make the arrangements. Rusty probably heard through the grapevine that some rich dude was looking to bag a Florida panther. The ranch hand figured it would be an easy side hustle, a quick way to pocket some cash.
He was seriously freaked that Billy knew his name, says Summer.
Another glorious moment,
Dad chuckles, flicking a cinnamon crumb from his chin.
I bet poor Rusty had to go change his underwear.
All that really matters is that Lincoln Chumley Baxter IV never got a chance to kill that cat. By now, the panther is probably all the way to Glades County and still running hard. Baxter must be spooked, too, knowing he was followed to the ranch. Even though our mission went the opposite of smooth, it turned out okay. The only casualty was the drowned drone. And blisters, says Summer, holding up her palms. She'd wailed on that dead pine tree with all her might. Too bad we couldn't see Lincoln Baxter's reaction when all the banging, honking, and gunfire started. No doubt he phoned Rusty in a panic. It turned into a real bad day for both of them. As instructed, we followed the deputy's car back to Immokalee, where he leaves us at a service station. Dad walks away from the gas pumps to make a phone call, probably to Baxter's wife. Summer and I use the break to be responsible kids and check in with our moms. Mine is busy on an Uber pickup, and she can't talk long. I tell her we saw a wild panther, which she agrees is amazing luck. Lil is guiding 2 anglers down the Madison River, so she also only has time for a quick hello. Summer tells her the Everglades is crazy beautiful, but the bugs are beastly. When she hears about the panther, Lil wants to know if it was bigger or smaller than a Montana mountain lion.
Big enough, Summer laughs. When she gets off the phone, I decide to ask about her dad. She hasn't mentioned him once.
Because he doesn't exist,
she says. Everybody's got a father.
Biologically, that's true. But as for participating, you know, being a functioning member of the family unit, my dad has less than zero presence. He's a Lakota, not that it makes a difference. He lives far away from here.
What does he do?
Stares at the walls, I guess. He's in prison, Billy.
God, I'm sorry.
God, don't be.
Summer manages a smile.
He's right where he belongs.
I've said too much already. But you know how some people have a talent for changing the subject? Not me.
Why'd he get locked up?
I ask.
He beat up my mom.
In front of you?
Same as always, she says. Only this time, they had to carry him off on a stretcher. I honestly don't remember hitting him, but he definitely ended up bloody on the ground. The cop showed me what was left of the snow shovel. I went a little bonkers, they said.
How old were you?
8. The shovel was practically bigger than me. Mom and I, we never talk about the drunken ass. We don't even speak his name. The man does not exist for us anymore.
What man? I say.
Thank you.
I look out the window at Dennis Dickens, pacing around the parking lot, still talking on his cell. He's far from a perfect father, but I don't believe he'd harm a soul. It's hard to think of what Summer and Lil experienced, trapped under the same roof with someone who just explodes like a landmine.
Your dad's in his own flaky world, Summer is saying, but it's not a scary world, okay? Mom and I would vote for flaky over scary any day.
Still, all those years and not a phone call. I mean, come on, Belinda might never forgive him.
I'd be pissed too, Billy. In some ways, Dennis is a kick-ass dude chasing these hardcore poachers all by himself. For that, he should get mad respect, right? But in other ways, he's a big, dopey chicken, too scared to call you and your sister. But hey, at least he's here now. My old man? I hope I never lay eyes on him again. That's a cold, true fact.
Summer's view throws a different light on my situation, I admit. It's a reminder there are fathers way worse than mine. After he gets off the phone, Dad confirms he was speaking to Daisy Baxter. She said her husband seemed extremely agitated when he called her earlier. He wouldn't tell her what he'd been doing or what happened, but she correctly concluded that the poaching expedition had fallen apart. According to my father, Mrs. Baxter was elated to learn the panther got away. Her husband's rotten luck apparently didn't end in the woods this morning. On the road, heading south from Immokalee, we noticed a black Range Rover flying by in the opposite direction, tailgated by a jacked-up mud truck driven by a scowling red-haired man. My guess is that Rusty the ranch hand wants Lincoln Chumley Baxter IV to explain how Rusty's name fell into enemy hands. If I were Baxter, I wouldn't take my foot off the accelerator. Dad was heading toward the cross-state highway they call Alligator Alley, the quickest route back to the East Coast, but Summer and I talked him into staying one more night. There's a campground on Chokoloski Island, across the causeway from Everglades City, the fishing village where Mom had settled for a while with me and Belinda. Last summer, this part of South Florida got smashed by a monster hurricane named Irma. Everything was underwater for days. I'm wondering what happened to our old neighborhood, so I give Dad driving directions. Somehow, the houses on our block are still standing. The one we lived in is a small yellow wood frame with a screen porch. You can see a brown water line running 5 feet high along the outside walls, but otherwise, the place looks pretty good. Amazingly, the hurricane didn't knock down the giant royal poinciana tree in the yard. Dad is smiling as he looks over the place.
I totally see why your mother picked this house, he says. The new owners have a bay boat on a trailer in the driveway and two candy-striped paddle boards propped against a side wall. The mailbox is painted to look like a strawberry grouper with its jaws open. I text a picture to Mom. At the campground, we're eagerly greeted by clouds of saltwater mosquitoes, so we set up our tent at world record speed. While waiting for a bag of ice at the marina, I notice two bald eagles flying in a clockwise circle over the bay. From a distance, most adult eagles look alike, but I'm wondering if these are the same birds Mom took us to watch when we lived here, the same pair whose nest got trashed by the funnel cloud. I kept telling her they'd come back, but she wouldn't believe me. Even though many of the buildings in Everglades City have been fixed up since Irma, I wasn't expecting to see much wildlife. The eagles are a nice surprise. I'm definitely going to tell Mom they're the same ones. It's too buggy to cook outdoors, so we go to a restaurant I remember near the Stone Crab Docks on the Barron River. The place looks brand new. Photos on the wall show the wreckage of the kitchen and splintered docks after the hurricane. We take a table by the water. Dad says he and Summer will start the long drive home to Montana tomorrow after dropping me off in Fort Pierce. You've got to go back so soon? I ask. I promised Lil, says Dad. I've been away a lot lately. Too much. And I get that. Billy, you think Belinda would like Montana?
I don't know. All depends.
Summer cackles.
It's humanly impossible not to like Montana.
Belinda's got the boyfriend thing going on, I say.
Me too, but if I had to choose between Davy and the Rocky Mountains, Davy's history.
Dad says, just for a visit, I was hoping, before she goes off to college. Your mother might want to come along too. Lil won't mind. It's like he's trying to bring all the people in his life together with one big move. That might be a tough fit. I'll ask Mom, I promise, and Belinda too. We order fish tacos, slaw, corn on the cob, and a pitcher of iced tea. While we're waiting, an osprey swoops down and plucks a shiny mullet from the river. It occurs to me that the same kind of bird is doing the same kind of thing to some poor trout 2,000 miles away on the Yellowstone River. After dinner, Dad says he wants to witness my snake-grabbing skills in person. Summer's down for a night drive through the Everglades, too. I tell them about a prime reptile zone along a dirt road in the big cypress swamp. By the time we arrive, it's already dark. Usually, this is when the action starts. My father switches on his high-beam headlights and brakes the truck to a crawl. Traveling snakes often stretch to their full length, but sometimes they rest in the shape of an S. Other times, they just coil up. They're not always easy to spot from a moving vehicle, but all three of us have sharp eyes, especially Summer, it turns out. On the first pass, our catch is two garter snakes, a 4-foot king snake, a corn snake, and a little ringneck spied by Summer moments before the truck almost flattened it. Summer and Dad get out to observe each of the captures. One of the garter snakes nicks a knuckle when it snaps at me, but that doesn't count as a legit bite. We didn't bring a pillowcase, so I release every snake after we take a few pictures. Dad gets a cool shot of Summer with the black and orange ringneck curled around one of her pinkies, like an exotic piece of jewelry. He texts the photo to Lil, while Summer texts it to Davy, the boyfriend. On the return drive, we don't see any more snakes, although there's other critter activity. At one point, Dad stops the pickup to let a mother raccoon lead her three babies across the road. Later, we roll up on a fat old opossum that won't budge. It just blinks at the headlights and bares its pointy teeth, a standard opossum bluff. Dad casually lifts the snarling grouch by its pale, hairless tail and moves it into the woods. Personally,
I'd rather deal with an angry snake any day.
The campground is silent and dark by the time we return to church.